If you like hashtag amwriting, and I know you do because you're here listening, you will love Writing Class Radio. Writing Class Radio airs true personal stories and gives you tips on how to write your own stories. We're also open to airing and discussing your personal essay. Everyone has a story. What's yours? Find Writing Class Radio wherever you find your podcasts.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting, the show about writing all the things. Short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, essays, pitches, proposals. This is the weekly podcast about sitting down and getting that writing work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I am the author of The Gift of Failure and the brand new out on the market, The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. And you can find my work at The Washington Post and The New York Times and various other outlets.
And I am KJ Delantonia, author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog at the New York Times, and right now waiting for edits on the next novel and trying to come up with an idea for what I hope will be number three, which is harder than I remembered it. Yeah. So that's what I've got. And we have a guest today. We are super excited to welcome Kristen Van Ogtrop, who has a wonderful book of essays out currently and is the former editor of Real Simple and has a previous book of essays. That's what an editor does when they're writing an essay. They write an edit-ay. Yeah. Okay. And we are super excited to talk about lots of things like why essays and why this and why that and all sorts of things. So welcome, Kristen. Thanks for coming.
Well, thanks for having me, you two. I'm a fan of your podcast and I'm in awe of the fact that you two can do a podcast and write books and I don't know how it's possible for you, but I'm super glad to be here.
The podcast is fun.
It is super fun. Mostly. It's, you know, it also keeps us checking in with each other every week and seeing how we're doing and where things are going and what our ideas are. And it's really fun for us too.
Yeah, that is really why we started it.
Yeah, but fun doesn't mean it doesn't take up any time.
True. No, it definitely still takes up time.
True. Fun still takes time.
Can't That's argue true. With that.
That's true.
Her current book is Did I Say That Out Loud? Midlife Indignities and How to Survive Them. And the previous book was Just Let Me Lie Down. And I don't remember the subtitle of that one either. Subtitles.
Oh.
We need them.
Necessary Terms for the Half-Insane Working Mom.
Yeah.
That was the subtitle of the first one. I'm less insane, I think, than I was the first time around. So, which probably has something to do with tiredness and wisdom. More tiredness than wisdom, probably, but
yeah,
no insanity in the subtitle this time.
So, two books of essays, and I wanted to ask why that format? Why not a memoir? Why not a novelized version of your time at Condé Nast? Which I personally love a good novelized version of anyone's
time
at Condé Nast. why essays?
I think. You know, it wasn't a deliberate decision. It wasn't something that I said, I am going to write a book of essays. I mean, the first book was organized like a dictionary from A to Z. And so it had some longer pieces that were essays. And then it had some really short, goofy sort of terms and definitions, humorous. Well, that was my intention at least. That working moms could identify. I mean, hopefully lots of moms could identify with, but particularly working moms. I think that, working as the editor-in-chief of a magazine for 13 years, where every month I had to write an editor's letter, which was about 1,000 words long, probably, maybe a little bit less. And then I had a column for Time for about 4 years. And I think that that form, I don't know if it was that I had those muscles already, you know, and they just got bigger, or if that practice made those muscles appear and you know, and made them important in my whole system. So I think essays, I feel like essay collections can get a bad rap sometimes. But I don't care. Like I look at UKJ and I could never, you know, when I was in between jobs, between leaving my magazine career and then starting to work as a literary agent, which is what I've been doing for the past 2 years, I tried writing a novel and I wrote maybe two novels in my 20s. And I'm not good at that. And it's really hard.
I totally agree. I have two novels in my head that I tinker away at in my head and occasionally work on paper. And it is so hard for me. Whereas the nonfiction writing is just joyful and flows out. And I don't know if that's a matter of practice. I don't know if that's a matter of just what I'm used to I'm definitely going to keep taking a whack at the novel stuff, but it's really weird how hard that is for me.
It's really hard. I think I'm just not, I think there are two things. One, I'm really not very good at making things up. Like I was never like the mom who told my kids bedtime stories that she made up. Like I just can't, I'm not good at making things up. And then two, my mom said to me recently, I have two sisters and one of them is really disciplined and she's just, you know, she's amazing in a lot of ways, but when she is faced with a problem, she's going to fix that problem and figure it out if it kills her. And I was kind of marveling at that part of her personality to my mom. She's like, you know, when you were growing up, her name is Valerie. If Valerie was faced with something that was a challenge, she just worked really hard. She worked as hard as she needed to overcome that challenge. If you were faced with something that was really hard, you did something else. So I think, KJ, that's why I write essays, because I can, and I can't do the other ones. I can't do the other kind of writing.
I guess I find it a little interesting because I feel like I can't right now. I'm essayed out. I am empty. I have written all the essays that I have in me for the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but you did it for a long time too, though, right?
I did it for a long time. So yeah.
I hope my well doesn't run dry, but it might. Who knows?
I don't know. But I've got something. I've got something else. So
I'm doing fine. Really great. Something else.
So for this book, which is not so, the first one has had a organizing principle around these definitions and terms. Did you start off that way?
Yes.
Or did you? Okay. So that one, you sort of, and to me, that makes it easier.
Sort of. Yeah.
Right. This one, on the other hand, you needed to create a structure for these essays that would pull the reader through the book. Can you talk about finding that path for the essays?
Well, I don't know. I didn't create a structure for this book beyond figuring out what order they were going to go in.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, really. Yeah. I mean, I think figuring out what order that they're in is hard and important. And maybe did you find some gaps, you know, where you needed to add something? I'm interested in how that worked out.
Mainly, we also talked with Jenny Lawson just recently about this as well.
Okay,
and she was saying that, you know, there were moments when actually it was her editor who found those, you know, these should go next to each other because this kind of makes sense in ways that Jenny hadn't even, it hadn't occurred to her that those things could go together. And that's always been, and this also reaches back, you'll love this. This reaches way back to when there was this woman I idolized, this writer that I just idolized. And I was writing essays at the time and I was trying to figure out, you know, sort of what the thread was, what the overarching thread was. And I brought that up at a book workshop and she just shamed me in front of the whole group. And she was like, you just write. You don't look for the through line. You just write and you blah, blah, blah. And so there's been this really weird tension. But when I talk to authors about their work, they're either like, oh no, you just write it and you hope that the through line just sort of happens because that's part of the collective unconscious.
We haven't actually talked to anyone real who does that.
That's true. That is true. Just the mean lady. Just that one mean lady.
Just the mean lady.
Yeah. So yeah. did you see these through lines, or did you have your agent or editor see these things in a way that you didn't?
So I'm going to defend the mean lady for a second, because this also speaks to sort of how I wrote the book over the period of a couple of years. And so that's like, that was like three questions. So I'm going to try to answer all three questions. So
we're prone to that.
That's okay. And by the third, I won't remember what it was. So the first thing is, you know, the through line really is just things that are understandable to people who are over the age of 40, basically, where they will relate to the experiences. And the role of my editor there, Tracy Behar at Little Brown, who was just, this is the second book I've done with Tracy. And well, I've only done two books and I've done both with Tracy. And she's just really, she's a wonderful editor. And so in her very gentle way, Tracy would say to me, you know, I think you need to do like, for instance, there's an essay about friendship, about adult friendship in the book. And that was Tracy's idea. She said, I think you need to write something about friendship. So, and there may have been one other like that. Maybe it was aging parents. It was something that obviously for this demographic is really important and a thing that you think about and worry about and do well or do badly. But there were, within the essays themselves, when Tracy would read them, sometimes she would say, I really like this, but I don't think you are hitting the theme of the book hard enough. And then, so then I would go back and revise and I would add to it. In terms of the organization of the book, you know, it's mostly funny, or I hope that it's mostly funny. And the feedback that I've gotten about the book is I think that's people.
You're allowed to say it's funny. It's funny. I've read it. It's funny.
Well, funny is in the eye of the beholder, but yeah. Thank you, KJ. But there's some essays in there. There's one about the loss of a pet. There's one about a friend of ours, dear friend, who died before the age of 60. There are a couple of there, and the one about my aging parents who are both, you know, still alive, which is a miracle and one, not a miracle, but I think, you know, I'm 57. I'm almost 57, and the fact that both of my parents are alive, both of my husband's parents are alive. I think that we are a statistical anomaly, and we're lucky for that. But anyway, those are a little more serious or sad, those essays. And so I wanted to spread those out a little, but then also not them be have them be preceded. Like when you're writing an essay about a friend dying of cancer, you don't want that to be preceded by why you're in love with your Roomba, you know? So I do think the virtue of a book of essays is you can dip in and out. You know, you don't have to read it all the way through from front to back, and when I read essay collections, I tend not to read them from front to back. I tend to look for chapters that look interesting to me, and I kind of jump around a little bit. And then the third consideration for the order was, actually I have two more things I want to say. So for the order, we really wanted the essay about swallowing the piece of fork to go first because we loved the cover art.
Love the cover art, by the way. Love the cover art.
And so that's kind of what made that first essay come first, because of the cover. But going back to the mean lady at the workshop, Jess, you know, when I was in between jobs, which is when I started writing this book, and I probably wrote four of the essays in this book when I was between jobs, I've got this friend named Jim Baker who wrote a novel called The Empty Glass that came out probably 10 or 15 years ago. And Jim and I, when he knew that I had left my job and he knew I was trying to write, he said, you need to sit down and write with no attachment to outcome. And so I wrote no attachment to outcome on a post-it note and I put it on my desk. And I thought, I don't know what this is going to be, but I'm just going to write and then just see what happens. And so that's kind of the mean lady method a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. Except yours was on a post-it and mine was, you know, yelling at me in front of, you know, 16 other writers.
There might be something in the delivery.
It's interesting also that you say that, because we interviewed someone just recently who said that she always tries to have a project going that she has no agenda for, that's not attached to a deadline or someone else's expectation of what it's going to be. And that's what's allowed her to to write outside of the genre that she normally writes in and is very, very successful in. She's a romance writer, and she also has written a couple of thrillers, and those thrillers were her, I'm just going to have this thing that's just for me, not for anyone else, so that I can really just put something out there that and remove the fear.
Yeah.
I think that's really smart.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good side hustle, huh?
Yeah.
To have like your little fun project turn into a whole thriller.
Yeah, she's done two of them. This is Nalini Singh who we just interviewed recently. Yeah. Yeah, and it's worked out well for her because her thrillers and her romances are both fantastic. So,
yeah.
You know what I think about a lot? I mean, I know you guys are both mothers too. So in those Elena Ferrante novels, the Neapolitan Quartet, there are times in the story of that character's life where she stops writing because motherhood gets in the way or the rest of her life gets in the way. And then she just picks it up again. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of talk recently about who is Elena Ferrante, is Elena Ferrante that man, whoever that is, the newly think she is. But I think about that all the time. Like, can a writer really do that? Just stop for a long period of time and pick it back up again, and it's all just still as good or powerful or compelling, or I don't know. And I realize that's fiction. She's a fictional character. I do know that.
Yes.
But
I have observed that fictional characters' art is much easier to minimize. My fictional character's art is so much better than my real art.
But I also
it's easier
think,
to do.
You know, I've puzzled over that alongside the question of, is Elena Ferrante a man?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that how a man
who might
would
imagine
view?
That right. That is how motherhood would take you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is an like, interesting
I'm
going to
go be a mother for a while, and then I'm going to come back and be like a really successful writer.
And it'll just be fine.
Yeah, and it's all just going to be, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the clue we're missing.
Maybe. No woman would see it that way. Plus, when the mothering is the worst, that is, or the hardest, that is often when people feel most compelled to put it on paper.
Yeah.
Or at least that has been my experience as an editor.
Yeah, that there have been some of my favorite things I've written have felt particularly urgent because of the, I just need to scream out into the void experience. I need someone to listen to me about this, and no one else will here in the house. So that's a good reason to do these things too.
Well, let's take this chance to jump into switching from being an editor to being a literary agent. And, as a baby editor, you were definitely reading and choosing and, you know, intimately involved in both long and short pieces for the publications that you worked for. I would imagine that as the editor in chief, it was more of a macro thing.
Right.
So how does the editing relate to the literary agenting?
Well, they're similar. They're very similar in some ways, which is you're just looking for great writing or great content that you think there's an audience for who's willing to part with their money to read it. The mechanisms and the characters are all really different, but one of the things that's similar, which is really great, is that when you're an agent, you can kind of, you're a professional dilettante basically, and good magazine editors are professional dilettantes too. And you can sort of pick and choose things that you're interested in. You don't get pigeonholed, you know, into like one mm-hmm. sort of thing. And so, you know, as an agent, I've sold a really weird range probably of books that are just appeal to me in one way or another. And the nice thing about moving into the book business, which is not part of your question, KJ, but it's something that I think about a lot, is that it's not a dying business. So that part's super nice. print, we just read last week, like print book sales are up, I think almost 30%, over 20% in the first quarter of this year, which is amazing, right? Remember when like ebooks were going to kill print books? Remember that?
Yeah, but no, it turns out they're just gravy.
Yeah. So it's nice too to be working in an industry that feels where you just don't feel like you're on the Titanic. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that the people on the Titanic knew they were on the Titanic, but sometimes when you're in a failing magazine, you don't know you're on the Titanic either. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's similar in some ways. I mean, one way that's very different is that, you know, when you work for a magazine, you work as part of a really collaborative team. And it's almost like you are working on an assembly line and you're all putting a different part on the car. And at the end, you have a car. And once a month, you make a new car and you've all made it together. When you're an agent, working for an agency like Inkwell, which is a mid-sized literary agency, all the agents who work at Inkwell are sort of like, we're all kind of planets that are orbiting the same sun, but we're not on the same planet with each other, really. We send messages to each other from planet to planet, but we're not all working together building the car on the assembly line. And that part's really different.
How did you make that move?
So when I left magazines, and I, you know, I write about this in a chapter of the book because it was a great career. It was just a really, really fantastic career. And in fact, when I interacted with both of you, I was probably in like one of the happiest points of my life, you know, but it just got really sucky. When I was kind of approaching the age of 50, and this is true, I think, for a lot of my friends who were in midlife and looking at their careers and thinking like, really? Like, is this the thing forever? And I was lucky enough that I was able to leave Time Inc. And all I wanted to do when I was so miserable and I left, right? I write about this in the book. And all I wanted to do was take a pottery class. I took a pottery class. I suck at pottery. I'm just the worst ever. But I know that about myself now. That wasn't my destiny, to be a professional potter or ceramicist, whatever they're called. But, you know, there were things that I always, and I don't know if you two have ever felt this way, like, you know, raising kids and being a relatively intelligent person in the world, like you always think, oh, should I have actually been doing that other thing all along? You know, was that?
I also think in my head about applying for jobs all the time. Like I'll drive by a place and they'll have a for hire sign out. And I'm like, yeah. I could do that job. Should I be doing that job? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we joke amongst ourselves and with other people. It's like everything. Yeah. When I hear something like, well, NPR's president has stepped down, I'm like, could I be the president of NPR? And on the other hand, it's like, you know, and look, King Arthur needs a baker. Yeah. I could do that.
Wait a second.
I could do that is my reaction to literally.
This week for me, it was Forest Ranger. So, you know.
Oh. It would be a beautiful place to work, unless it was cold and rainy, I guess. So, KJ, I was listening to a podcast recently that you were on, and now, of course, I can't remember which one it was, but you were talking about this very thing. You were talking about you reach a point, and I guess this says something about becoming kind of a self-actualized adult, where you think, like, I could be the president of NPR. Like, why the hell not?
So I can do that.
I was like that. I was thinking that way, but I also like, should I have been a stay-at-home mom this whole time? I was never a stay-at-home mom. Should I have been working for a nonprofit this whole time? I never did that. You know, so I took 2 years where I tried on these different hats and like nothing. I took the shitty pottery class, not a shitty class, but Kristen's a shitty pottery person. I was a stay-at-home mom. My youngest son was in fourth grade. And so I, you know, like walked him to and from school every day and was much more involved in his life probably than he wanted or than I had been with his older brothers. Then I did some nonprofit volunteering. I did some nonprofit consulting. And all along, like each one was like, no, that's not really it. That's not quite it. And when I left Time Inc., my agent, who's one of the partners at Inkwell, his name is Richard Pine, he sent me an email and he said, you know, you really need to either write another book or you need to come work at Inkwell as an agent. And I was like, all right, okay, sure. You know, like I didn't want to do anything. But I sort of stored it, I guess, mentally. And when my son was going into middle school, I had this realization, and I write about this in the book too. Like there was a moment on the day of the solar eclipse in 2017, the total solar eclipse, where I had this sudden realization, like, you've got to get yourself back into an office, lady, or you're just like, you do not belong here. And so I started talking to Richard, and he and the two other partners at Inkwell, there are three partners, Richard and Kim Witherspoon and Michael Carlisle. And they thought, okay, like they were willing to take a risk on a 50 something year old woman who'd never been an agent before. And so that's how it happened. That's a long answer, KJ, but that's how it happened.
Was there like a little intern period?
Oh my God, I'm still in the intern period.
Okay.
I'm such a dummy.
Talk to us as though one of us was like, I could be as we both totally are. I could be a literary agent. I don't think either of us are heading in that direction. But, you know, how's it going? Like, what is that transition like?
Well, so at first, you know, there's an editor at Simon & Schuster named Priscilla Payton, who worked at Time magazine for many years, really wonderful woman who keeps publishing these bestsellers. Walter Isaacson's book right now is her current one. And she and I went to lunch shortly after I started working at Inkwell, and she said, and she had left Time Inc. and gone to Simon & Schuster maybe almost 10 years before I left magazine publishing. And she said, the first year was so hard, and I carried the little notebook around with me wherever I went, and I asked so many questions, and I wrote the answers down in the notebook. And I grew to understand what she was talking about. Like, there's so many things you don't know, you know? And you do have this, you know, when you're in your 50s and you've had success in one thing, as, you know, we're talking about, you do have this kind of, like, belief that, hey, I could, you know, I'd probably be pretty good at that. And you don't, but the good, and you're not, as it turns out, or it doesn't come as naturally as you think it will. But the good thing about it is if you've reached the age where you're not afraid to be embarrassed and ask stupid questions.
Mm-hmm.
So like the 25-year-old Kristen becoming an agent would be much more embarrassed and self-conscious to look foolish in asking questions she should know the answer to. Whereas the 57-year-old Christian's like, I don't care. I don't care if I look like an idiot. I need to learn this. So it's, you know, it's learning a whole new group of people. You know, when I first started working, I said to Richard, my agent and now boss, what I want is a giant chart of the different publishing houses and like the hierarchies. I want like an org chart. Does a huge publishing org chart exist? And he's like, no. But you know what? That would have saved me like 3 months of learning.
We've actually fantasized about making these for sourcing when you need to source something. Or I was talking to Laura Mays, who does the Mom 2.0 conference. And so many relationships I have now really all go back to that conference. And I would love to have, there used to be on the show, The L Word. One of the characters had this, it was one of those circle charts with lines going out about people who have formed relationships and how they're all interconnected. And she had a big wall that had all these circles and lines. I've always wanted to make one of those for, like, you know, sort of all the people I know that and write all the writers I know and how we met each other and how we know each other. I've always wanted to make one of those. It just sounded like fun.
Yeah.
Something to procrastinate from writing. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you do when you've got a deadline, like in 2 days, and you need something to, you know, procrastinate on your deadline. But I think that publishing org chart, that publishing chart would be an invaluable resource, because most people, when I talk to them about books, don't even understand what an imprint is, let alone, you know, so the idea that you have this publisher, but it's actually an imprint of that other publisher is just a whole concept that most people don't even know about.
Yeah.
So it's like you kind of felt good probably about your ability to do the core task, which is to look, you know, to look at someone's manuscript and evaluate how salable
yes
it is or could become, which is key. Yes. But knowing to whom specifically, mm-hmm. at what house, and under what circumstances, and for what amount of money, and with what details, I guess. Whoa, yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And also knowing, like, what kinds of books are harder to sell than others, just as mm-hmm. kind of categories and, you know, all that stuff. But a lot of it is about relationships. You know, when I'm coming into this, forging new relationships at a time when, you know, the people who are my peers in terms of age did it 20 years ago.
Right. They're probably excited to see someone new. Well, we could probably talk for hours about becoming a literary agent and what a literary agent is looking for. And I'm a little sad that we're not going to, but sorry, folks, we're not, because we're going to take a quick break and we're going to talk instead about what we've been reading. Spring is coming, slowly, here in New England, and we're excited about the whole idea of change and new beginnings and birds and grass and stuff like that. What does that have to do with hashtag AmWriting? Well, maybe it's time for a new beginning for you as a book coach. Just imagine enrolling in the classes, meeting a cohort, learning all the ways coaches are editorial and emotional support for writers, and then starting to line up your first clients. Students working with Author Accelerator's book coaching program say they often begin to book authors before they're even done with the course, and they end up being booked ahead months in advance. Sound like fun? I absolutely agree. Go to bookcoaches.com to learn more. And we always like to start with our guest. So tell us something you have been reading and loving lately.
Okay, so I have been reading this book that came out, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago. The writer is Gabrielle Glazer. I don't know if you guys might know Gabrielle. Her husband used to work at the Times, actually. Steve Engelberg is the name of her husband. But Gabrielle wrote this book called American Baby that Viking published. And it's about the adoption system in America in the last century. It tells the story of this one family, a young Jewish girl who got pregnant when she was a teenager, was sent to this home on Staten Island where young Jewish girls who got pregnant were sent, and then gave up the baby and then tried for years and years and years and years and years to find him. And what's so great about this book is that it does something, it's kind of like you writing novels, KJ, or like you, Jess, like I could never write a Jess book. Like, Gabrielle Glazer is such an incredibly good reporter, but it reads like a novel. Mm-hmm. So you like learn something, but you're learning also, you're learning about adoption in America in that time, which was just bonkers and corrupt and terrible. But then you're also following the story of this one family whose lives were really kind of broken by this system.
I love people who can do that. That's a Tracy Kidder-esque, you know,
yeah.
People like that who can find that one story that takes you into an entirely different world.
Yeah, I could read House over and over and over again. I think there are certain books I sort of keep out there as touchstones of what I would like to be able to achieve with my writing. And that specifically that intersection of that creative nonfiction spot is just one of my favorite mm-hmm. places. That sounds really cool.
Whereas what I learned is that I will never be able to do that because I don't like to interview people at that level and then put it out there. I have too much anxiety around how they will feel about how they have been portrayed. So to use real people to tell a story like that is not, I can use real people. My ability to use interviews is very specific. Mm. So I will never be that, but I love to read it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, highly recommend that one.
Sounds great. How about you, Jess? Read anything good?
Yes,
lately?
Because I've been texting you about it, you two about it, because I have been, my brain is so fried right now with Pub Week stuff, and that's great.
Understandably.
I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I've been listening to light, suck you in stories that get you from the beginning. And number one, of course, is Serena Bowen's new book, Bombshells, came out this week. And the cool thing about that book is she's been queuing up the idea of there being, this is from the Brooklyn Bruiser series, so it's always been about this professional hockey team in Brooklyn, but she's been queuing up the idea of a women's team at the same time. And I mean, she's told us little bits and pieces about things as we went along. But I was explaining, I was telling my husband I was really excited to read this because we finally get to meet the first person on this team. And because, of course, Serena loves talking about the economics of things, the numbers of things, she gets in a little bit to the whole what the salary cap is in the for the men and what the salary cap is for the women. And the salary cap for the men is like something insane, like 27 or some huge millions of dollars. And for the women, it's like $11,000 or, you know, $27,000 or something like that. One of the players is making $11,000 anyway. And they have to get like a side hustle in order to be to be able to play professional hockey. So it's been really cool. And how she's fitting, you know, the Brooklyn Bruiser series for the most part has been just a lot of guys. And so now she's getting the Bombshells, is the Brooklyn Bombshells is the name of the female team. And I'm so excited. I've been reading that. And then we've been going back and forth about how much we all adore Abby Jimenez. And she has a couple of books, but the one that I started with originally that I think is my favorite is called The Happy Ever After Playlist. Amazing meet and greet where with the girl and the guy sort of... But she has a new one that I think all of us are reading at the moment, which is,
Life's Too Short.
Thank you.
I finished it. Serena has my copy and you are listening to it.
It is delightful.
Yes, it's really good. And it hit the bestseller list this week. So congrats to her because that is pretty
Happy
awesome.
Ever Playlist, Life's Too Short. Both just like suck you in, can't stop. I listen, but you know, it's just, I love them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Agreed. And I am not reading anything new. Oh, actually, I did. I did read something new. Go me. Matt, pat on back. It is called Brood. And it is a strange meditation on replacing on coming to the realization that a person cannot have the children that they have wished for, and basically sort of substituting temporarily a brood of chickens. And it is first person, very intimate, and I do recommend it, or I wouldn't be bringing it up. If it appeals to you at all, it's pretty fascinating. But it is just this really like close, claustrophobic look at this life that is not going as this person planned. And how the chickens are giving her something that she didn't get, but that doesn't always, I mean, you don't want to put all your eggs in a chicken basket. they are not long-lived, healthy or intelligent creatures. So there's some bad stuff that happens basically to sum up, but I really liked it. And that is Brood. And I will look up the author and put it in the show notes because I don't remember, but it is brooding. That's what it is.
Excellent.
That's the title, I'm sure.
Well, you actually just reminded me, by the way, it is chick season around here, and all the stores around here have those signs that say the chicks are in. And every time we drive by, my husband looks over at me, he's like, no, 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 no. And I'm like, no, I'm just looking. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know what you're talking about. And actually, Finn mentioned needing a baby goat the other day, too. So I'm like, I'm banned from looking at any livestock, including the chickens these days. So,
yeah. Well, we are a dedicated chicken family, but everybody's pretty much on board. So
my sister just got goats, and they're really, really cute.
They're the best.
Goats are cute. And I have an empty shed.
I've been lobbying for KJ to get goats and possibly a donkey or a mini donkey. I'm going to keep working on her on that one.
Donkeys are really noisy. No donkeys. No.
The goats. My sister's goats are pretty noisy too.
Oh yeah,
but they're super cute.
Yeah, well, because they get when they want you to come over to them, they start bleeding. I don't know. Do goats bleed?
Yeah, I believe
that is the noise that they make.
And it's insistent. Yeah. They really want you to come rub their ears or play with them or whatever it is. They're like pets. It's amazing.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Yeah. And the thing I've also learned about goats, by the way, is that there are goat people and there are non-goat people. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that their pupils are shaped in the opposite direction as most animals' pupils. And that freaks people out. It's very weird, but I love them.
I think I can handle it.
All right. Thank you.
So before we shut down, let's just let's say again to head out and get Christy's newest book.
Thank you.
Where can people find you, Kristen, if people want more information about your work and what you're up to?
So my website is kristenvanogtrop.com, and I'm K Van Ogtrop on Instagram and Twitter. And my books are just, you know, I encourage people obviously to go to their local independent bookstore right now, but you can go elsewhere.
Thank you.
Right. And so that the title again, because I think we got sort of washed over, is Did I Say That Out Loud?
And it has a fork and, missing, you know, one did, tine basically on the cover, and it's adorable.
And if you want to know why,
you'll have to read it.
All right.
Okay, everyone.
Nice, you too.
Thank you so much for being with us this week, Kristen. And until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.